I don't want to be too gross at lunch, but...
Menu, sir?
Oh, thanks a bunch. You can't just quarantine everyone who coughs. What's the special, hon?
Beef stroganoff.
Okay, we got. Let's take it again. So here's how it's gonna go, Dimitri.
Yeah, you're the guest on this one.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Hear ye, hear ye! All ye who hear this here podcast, know this: this podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing discussed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. The hosts hold no licenses and are not financial advisors. Do your own research before making investment decisions, and we do hope you enjoy this podcast.
Oh, this is going to be fun. All right, let's go.
Dimitri, welcome to TC's Charcast. So great that you could join us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You can refer to me as Charts throughout this interview, as has become your habit in our personal lives, and we're super excited to have you on.
That's true.
Super excited to have you on the podcast. Why do I have a feeling that this is going to be our Jim Grant episode?
Well, you're setting the bar very high, and I don't think that that's wise, but I'll take it.
Absolutely. So for the benefit of the audiences who may be listening, Dimitri and I are good friends as a result of my having been a guest on his podcast, and he certainly played a role in our motivation to launch TC's Chartcast, and so having him on the show is super exciting. And so Dimitri, you know, it's become a tradition on our show that the guests sort of give us a deep dive on their bio. Why don't you begin by telling us, you know, who you are, where you're from, where you went to school, and then how you made your way to doing podcasting full time.
Well, first, I got to tell you guys congrats. You guys have done an amazing job with this podcast. I actually, you know this because we joked about it. I joked that this was all like a ruse, your Tesla Charts Twitter account and this whole entire thing that really you were actually a stealth podcast host from the beginning, because you guys have shown such acumen and you have so much creativity. And it's really wonderful. It's congrats. I mean, seriously.
Go on. I'm kidding. Thanks, Dimitri.
But ask your question again, because I can't do too many things at once.
Just give us your bio. You know, where you're from, where you're born, where you went to school.
Where am I from? Well, this is long, so you're going to have to cut me off because I'm not very good at giving concise answers, but...
Oh, no. We don't cut people off on TC's Chartcast, except for this episode so far.
So I grew up all over the place. I was born in Cincinnati, lived for a year. My parents both immigrated here when they were 29, 30 years old, and I was born pretty much a few months after they got here. And we were in Cincinnati for a year, and then we moved to Queens. We lived in Astoria when my father was doing his residency, and he finished medical school in Greece, and he did his what's known as agrotiko, which is when you do a year of like community service medical care in some, you know, village in Greece. And he also did, I think it was 2.5 years back then, military service. So all that stuff. And then we lived in Queens for 4 years in Astoria. And then we moved to North Carolina. I lived in Winston-Salem when my dad was at Wake doing his fellowship and my mom was doing her master's. And lived there for 4 years, North Carolina. And then we moved to Pennsylvania. I lived in York, Pennsylvania for 4 years. And then moved back to New York. And I went to middle school and high school here. And then I went to college at NYU. And then I worked in Italy out of college. Then I worked briefly in the video game industry and then in interactive television application development and design. And then eventually got into the content side with my own blog, and which turned into a radio show, which turned into a TV show, and which has gone all over the map with a theater company and also this podcast.
Dimitri, you are first-generation American and of Greek heritage. You've mentioned that regularly in your own podcast, so I can only assume it has a pretty big influence on your life. Talk about that a little bit.
My engineer is Cypriot. We talk Greek all the time. That's the language we use. Yeah, it is. Like, you know, there's the stereotypical kind of influence that you get when you're Greek, which is, you know, Greeks are the best at everything. Everything, our history is, you know. But yeah, I mean, besides that, all my family's in Greece, except for my my father, my mother, my sister, and I have also my dad's brother and son and wife here. But the rest of my family's in Greece, and every summer I spent in Greece. Growing up, that was the only place that was like home because we moved around so much in the States. So that was where I had friends, and I still do, from when I was a kid. There's no other town in America or city where I have such long relationships. So it does mean a lot to me. And as you probably know, it's been the source of a lot of when I used to do these dreamy intros, which I love doing. I just stopped because they take so much energy, but hopefully I can do some again in the future. But I would take a lot of inspiration from specifically Greek mythology, though I love mythology in general.
Yes, certainly. That's clear. I mean, you've got, you know, there's such a foundation, the humanities have such a foundation in Greek philosophers and so forth, that I can see how that weaves its way through to your podcast. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up doing Hidden Forces and what that's all about and your vision for your podcast.
Well, I guess, you know, it's funny because what I do on Hidden Forces is, you know, I do it as a podcast, but if I was living 100 years ago, I guess, you know, the question is, what would I be doing, right? And I think one of the things that it does that I'm able to do with the program that I love so much is learn all these things, both in preparing. As you guys know, I prepare a lot for my conversations, and then in actually sitting down and deliberately asking questions and digging into subjects with people who are highly intelligent on a particular subject or experienced or have some inside knowledge about it. So there's that. It just feeds my inner curiosities. But then also, I just love conversations with people. And when my whole life, I love to have, you know, deep philosophical conversations, and it was honestly exhausting for everyone else around me. And it didn't make me super fun all the time. You know, I wanted to get into these conversations in all sorts of places, cocktail parties, family functions. And a lot of times people just wanted to have superficial chit chat. And it's funny because now that's all I want to have, superficial chit chat when I'm not doing this. You know, I get my fix when I do the show. But Hidden Forces, the idea for it came out of a book that I had signed an agency agreement to write, which came out of an article that I wrote for The Atlantic's Quartz magazine, which was about my experience having dementia and anterograde amnesia that was a result of a brain tumor that I was diagnosed with and lived with for a number of years before I had surgery and radiation. And so it was this just enormous psychosomatic ordeal. And I eventually wrote about it after a couple of years after my radiation ended. And I signed on to write this book. And when I was researching the book, it was the first time in years, really, since my surgery, where I started to reconnect with the things that I used to really love to learn. And it started with just reading biographies of, like, can't remember now. I mean, I read what's his name's Born on the 4th of July, and Mary Carr's book on how to write memoir, The Art of Memoir, and stuff like that, and a lot of other books that my agent gave me. And then that eventually progressed to reading stuff on neuroscience, and that got me back into science and tech. And then eventually I started getting back into finance, investing, markets, which was kind of the last thing that my curiosity started to percolate for again. And then I couldn't really focus on the book, and I just started thinking about Capital Account, which was my old television show, which ended in 2013, and which I loved doing so much, and it was such a formative part of my personal and career development. And thinking about what it is that I loved so much about it, what was it that I missed so much about it, And I kind of just started writing out what those things were. And I realized that it was, you know, doing stuff on financial markets. What I loved about financial markets and what I still love about financial markets is that it's arguably the most complex data set, certainly social data set that we have. And it's very difficult. People are always asking, what's driving the market? And the answers, no one has an answer to that. But in order to get to a decent, halfway decent answer, you have to look for really deep root causes or hidden forces. And I just thought about how that my interest in that cuts across categories, whether it's finance, whether it's technology, science, art, whatever it is. I'm always interested in what's really, can we go deeper here? What is it really that's driving this? And I wanted to do a program that allowed me to explore those themes. I also thought people wanted to hear about that kind of stuff. And I also wanted to do something that was not political, because my old television program, Capital Account, though it was not political, it had a tinge of activism. I was much more ideological. I was also very angry when I created that program. I created it from a place of anger as a result of the 2008 bailout, 2009 bailout, the rolling bailouts, really, and the way all of that was managed. And as someone who had been reading a lot of really brilliant Austrian minds before the crisis, I benefited from their analysis of the business cycle, and I was able to have a sense of what could happen. But what I didn't have was a sense of how the monetary authorities would react. Now we're all used to it. Now we're all conditioned to understand that the Fed and central banks around the world and governments are committed to supporting asset markets. Whether they can do it in all and every circumstance, you know, that is an open question. That is the question. But at the time, I think it's hard for people to really appreciate today who didn't live or who weren't sort of really aware of it during the time. And even if you were, I think it's easy to forget how new it was. And we live in the age of what was the unprecedented is now normal. So Hidden Forces was a desire to kind of cover all this stuff. Trump was obviously lighting up the Republican primaries, and politics was everywhere, and everyone was so triggered. And I wanted to do a program that wasn't political, where people could feel safe, so to speak, to just speak their minds and be intellectually curious and approach all sorts of different subjects without bias, if that's even possible.
So, Dimitri, lots to unpack there, and I know your story very well, but the audience, many members of our audience might not. Why don't you walk us through what Capital Account was, why you started it? And then as I recall from reading the article that you wrote about your experience and in talking to you, I think it was around the end of the Capital Account where you started to notice some of the symptoms of the tumor. Can you walk us through sort of that part of your life to give the full context of what we're going to talk about a little bit later as it pertains to the current podcast effort?
Yeah. Well, I was diagnosed in 2009 in the summer, July 2nd, 2009, with what is known as a craniopharyngioma, which is a non-malignant complex tumor that is located, or was located, and I think all of these are, in the middle, in the center of my brain, near the pituitary gland, behind the optic chiasm, below the hypothalamus, right there in the middle of the brain. And it was, at the time, relatively small, and there were no clear symptoms from the tumor. And so it was kind of this weird situation. Joe Rogan actually had someone on his program this week who had not this tumor, but a similar type of situation where they were diagnosed with something that wasn't creating any clear diagnosable symptoms, but which could. And so there's a whole kind of issue around how do you live your life in such circumstances where you're given a diagnosis of something whose impact can be catastrophic on your life, but currently is not. And the surgeries that are available were, at least in my case, were really bad, the ones that were given to me. I would have lost all of my hormone production. I would have been on all sorts of hormone replacement. And there was, I think, a one in three or one in four chance of blindness from the surgery. And there were different surgeries, but certainly like classic craniotomy would have caused could have caused blindness. There was also an almost 50-50 chance of morbid obesity, which is over 100 pounds of weight gain from hypothalamic damage. So these were really serious side effects. And as you can imagine, as a 28-year-old, this is the last thing I was expecting. You know what I mean? Like I this was so far from the scope of the problems that I envisioned in my life that it it's hard to really to convey what that experience was like in its totality, but it kind of set the stage for the rest of my life, because at the time I had a really great job. I was one of a few people who was part of a small team called Strategic Product Development. It was created by the chief engineer at Cablevision for future, kind of 5 years down the road, GUI interfaces, graphical user interface design for the set-top box and interactive applications on the box and motion remotes, and some of which has already been implemented since I left. But I wasn't really feeling it. It wasn't really what I wanted to be doing with my life. I think that's a common experience. A lot of people can find themselves maybe in what seem objectively good circumstances that don't feel right. And I think one of the problems often is the more objectively great the circumstance, the harder it is to square with your subjective experience of it, you know, because there's a sense of guilt, there's a sense of, well, I should be happy, but I wasn't. And the diagnosis compounded that, and it also revealed, it also highlighted really the choice available to me, which was to continue to be doing something that didn't feel like what I needed to be doing with my time. But given the fact that I now had a real sense of urgency, it no longer made sense to do it. I had a reason to quit, and I quit with no clear prospects. And it was super hard. I mean, I went through a lot emotionally. It was I wouldn't even call it a roller coaster. I mean, there were momentary it was, for the most part, it was like a drop. It was just like, it was a drop with like some stoppage. But eventually I found my way, and I ended up getting on radio. I had a blog that was doing relatively well, but I think it was just more highlighted my writing and my thinking on the subject of economics and markets and stuff like that. And that kind of got me noticed by the right people, and I got a radio show, and I had no experience in radio, and I just figured out how to do it. And in fact, my engineer who works with me, who's really phenomenal, and I'm so lucky to have him, he was recommended to me by my previous engineer and editor. Well, my previous engineer, he's my editor and engineer, but my previous engineer on radio. So I had this show, I called it Covering the Spread, and so that's kind of a play on words. And I used that to leverage my blog and my writing, and eventually something I wrote, it might not have been the first time, but it got picked up by Zero Hedge. It got picked up by a lot of other blogs, and eventually that got me on television. And I spent basically a couple of days when I was in Athens for a wedding. I got on television during what was one of many, over the course of years, protests. Seriously animated protests in Greece. And I got a taste of television, and I was good at it. I mean, I was good at extemporaneous analysis, at, I think in some sense, some theatrical presence as well, like having a sense of the moment. And I loved it. And again, like my brain tumor was such a big part of that, because I was so scared to go on television. I had no experience on TV. You know, my first time on television, I had the Acropolis to my back. I was at an old Alpha studio on Sigru, which is a huge, old, large kind of, wouldn't call it a highway, but when it was created, it would be considered a highway in Athens. And I had the Acropolis behind me. I was standing on this metallic podium. I had the sun in my eye. I had an IFB in my ear. I didn't know what an IFB was at the time. And I had someone just speaking in my ear, and I'm getting nervous. But every time I would get nervous, I would tell myself that I had a brain tumor and I could die soon. And that would just calm me down. It just gave me a perspective that helped me. And so that eventually led to me getting my own television show to create. And I didn't host the program. It was hosted by Lauren Lister, who was phenomenal. And we were a really great team, and she was a great host. And I kind of just drove the wheels off of that bus up until 2013, when, not because of the tumor, but around the time that I had made a decision, and actually talked about this in my episode that comes out shortly after this recording with Joshua Yaffa on Russia. We talk about my experience, just a little bit of it, at RT, and sort of the compromises I was and wasn't willing to make, and why I left. And so my choice to leave was independent of the tumor. But I think kind of the summer before I ended the program, about 6 months before I ended the program, I think was the first time I started developing symptoms. And those symptoms, I think, and it's hard to know. I can tell you sort of with certainty where I can visibly document symptoms. But I think the first symptoms were me playing Tetris, which I downloaded Tetris on my phone. And during pitch meetings or editorial meetings in the morning, when I was meeting with my host and my producers, I was sitting and just playing Tetris. And they were talking, and I was just playing Tetris incessantly. And it's funny because once I had surgery, I stopped playing Tetris, and I haven't picked it up since. And there's all sorts of reasons that I think that game soothed what was happening to my mind, and why I was able to do it so effectively, whereas other things became more difficult. But remarkably, I was able to continue to produce, and I was able to be on air. I think I got more disheveled as the time passed, because I think there was a stress on my brain perhaps from it. But the first clear symptoms were when I was driving down from D.C. With my in the U-Haul and everything else, coming down, moving to New York, and I found out that my grandfather had died. This was January 5th, and or maybe January 7th, and I forgot about that, and I didn't remember it until after my surgery, and that's basically the first sign of a deterioration of my memory that became so severe, to the point where I was on an airplane going to California to be in a documentary, where on the flight out there, I forgot where I was flying to. And if you asked me who the president was, I'd tell you it was Denzel Washington. This literally happened. I couldn't tell you what an animal was. I'd forget my birthday. How often I would call people and they were freaked out because I had just talked to them. And all those experiences were part of this deterioration in my memory, and particularly in my short-term memory, where I could get up, go to the bathroom, come back, and get lost in the restaurant, not know where my table was, who I was with. And when that happens to you, it's there's so many aspects of what that experience is like. But one of the things that I think people who haven't had dementia or who, you know, don't have Alzheimer's. Again, I did an episode recently with Eugenia Zuckerman, who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, has been living with it now for at least 2 or 3 years. You don't realize how scary it is when it starts to happen. And my reaction was, not only did I not want other people to know what was happening, but I also didn't want them to know because I didn't want to know. You know, like when you see in someone's face that it's such a look of concern, if they've just spoken to you, you don't remember. It's so aberrant. It's so off the charts in terms of, no pun intended, DC. Anyway, it was a very difficult experience for me in all sorts of ways. But I'm also very fortunate because it ended well.
Well, and you're on the other side of it now, and I'm very curious about your perspective as this was happening and the perspective of those around you. You know, you were in your 20s. I imagine there's quite a bit of cognitive dissonance with those that you're interacting with. You know, this is someone very young. It's hard to even expect that it might be dementia at play to explain some behaviors that must have been going on. How did you protect yourself through this? How did you anticipate or manage just in a day-to-day way?
You know, it's so funny. There are so many people that you guys know, that my audience knows, who I had dinner with, drinks with, met with, either for work or personally during this time, who had no idea. Because I also didn't know. I knew I had a tumor, but you remember, I actually didn't convey this when we were talking, but when I had been originally diagnosed with the tumor, they told me that since I didn't have symptoms, you know, don't have surgery. Well, some people gave me it. Actually, that's not true. That's the other problem. You get all sorts of, it's so difficult. We did another episode with Dr. Brian Kaufman, and we talk about this in terms of cancer. You get all sorts of different doctors. Different doctors can give you completely different prognoses and recommendations. But I decided to go the route of just out of sight, out of mind. If you're telling me that I should do nothing unless this thing presents symptoms because the surgery is worse than the cure, is worse than the disease, then I don't even want to think about it. You know, so I was never told that I would develop dementia. That was the last thing. That wasn't even mentioned. The things that I was looking out for were, and so I would take blood tests, you know, were like some impact on my hormone levels, you know, diabetes insipidus, which is, there are all these different things that I was looking out for, but not this. Blindness was another symptom, but I didn't have any of that stuff. So when I started developing symptoms, I wasn't really aware of it at first. And there are people, I won't mention them, not because I don't know that they would care, but well-known people. But I will mention one person, actually, because I think it's kind of interesting. I'm pretty sure that Grant Williams and I had dinner at a well-known restaurant here in New York in May, and I had surgery in June. And at the time, I was in full-blown. Like, my symptoms were really bad. And I don't remember, because it's been such a long time now since that happened. You know, after my surgery, it's almost as if I got all my memories back, and we can talk about that. But whenever you just let things go for a long time, you don't remember all the details. But I remember where we were. I remember having dinner with him. There was one other person with us, and we were there talking about a lot of things. That's an example, and that happened a lot. I don't know what Grant's impression was. I don't know that we talked about it much afterwards since it happened. But with some people, I did talk about it. I mean, someone I really admire and love very much, and you guys know, and who's a bit of a mentor to me, we had gotten together, and I'm pretty sure he thought I was on drugs. And this was not, you know, another person very well known who I have not had on my program. Similarly, I had been invited up to his home, and you know, lots of cases like this. You know, I describe it in my article as kind of like being a drug addict or something, where you're done, you're no longer an addict, but when you're done, when you're sober, you're looking back and you're looking at all the ways in which you compromised yourself in public that you wouldn't have if you weren't high, and it kind of was like that, and that was honestly a tough thing that it took a while to kind of understand that there was only so much apologizing that I could do, you know?
Yeah. So, Dimitri, when I reread your article to prepare for this episode, really touching part of it was your father and his participation in your health journey and the contrasting opinions with various bad options that were presented to you. And you referenced a surgery, which I would call miraculous. Talk to us a little bit about that. You know, you mentioned the episode you did with Dr. Kaufman. You know, patient journeys through the medical system are very complex. You were very fortunate. Your father is a practicing doctor. Talk to us about that journey and the surgery, and then we could get into the sort of miracle that happened afterwards.
Yeah. What can I say about my father? You know, I love my father so much. Everyone, well, not everyone, some people hate their parents. But, you know, my dad he's, I can't even find the words, you know, he helped me walk through the fire. You know, he helped me walk through the fire. It was hard. You know, you can imagine if you're a father and you have a son and he's losing his mind, and you're and my dad is by his nature someone who is a sort of kind of got to fix it kind of guy. And I think one of the benefits of this experience for all of us has been, you know, learning to make peace with some things that maybe you can't fix, or just being kind of just more understanding of the fact that entropy is real. You know what I mean? And but he, you know, he's a very brilliant physician. He's a very ambitious. He's always been an ambitious physician, which is why we moved around so a lot. He's a pioneer in his field. His field is, incidentally, obstetrics and maternal fetal medicine, and he is a high-risk pregnancy specialist, what's known as a perinatal diagnostic surgeon. And so he has some surgical background, but really, this is not his field, you know what I mean? But he's also a very generally curious person, and he put that to work, and, you know, he began to look for a cure. And we went through the first round of this, right, when we had the initial diagnosis, and I consulted a few physicians, and we decided to just hold off because the surgeries that we were looking at just didn't make sense. But we were also given by one doctor, for example, in Colombia, a suggestion not to do anything for now. So we didn't do anything because, again, this is one of those things where I've had this since I was born. I didn't mention this also, but craniopharyngiomas are, if I'm not mistaken, they're dislodged esophageal tissue that gets dislodged in the middle of the brain during embryonic development. So it's kind of one of those things that I think in most cases it's found when you're very young. It's a pediatric tumor. In fact, almost all the people that were around me when I was going meeting with doctors were kids, which is a whole nother story. And so I forget where I was going, guys. I had a moment where I was thinking about these kids and
the surgery and your choices and tough choices and then the
my dad,
the miraculous
my
path
dad,
you chose dad, with dad. Partnership yeah. with your dad.
Yeah, well, he's so, you know, you mentioned Brian Kaufman. I mean, he was my advocate, my father. I was scared, you know. I was genuinely scared because I didn't want to you know, I think also since I was a kid, I don't know if this is a common thing, but I whenever I'd get like a headache, I thought it was like a tumor. You know, like in Kindergarten Cop when he's like, "It's not a tumor." But like there's like a scene, you know, that's like that was, I had this thing and I would get these crazy migraines when I was a kid. So I don't think that had anything to do with it, but you know, so I was terrified, and I was terrified of looking at brain images, and I just didn't want to deal with it. It was horrible. It terrified me, frightened me. But when you're dealing with something so serious, your health is contingent on your engagement with your illness or your disease or your cancer or your tumor, whatever it is. You've got to take an active role in that. And that's really hard, and that's why it's so helpful to have people who love you who can help you. And in this case, I couldn't have been luckier. I had a father who was not only a kind of can-do person, but also a physician, and a brilliant physician and a brilliant thinker and a creative mind. And he was determined to try and help. And there was a period where it really wasn't clear if we were going to get anywhere, and he, you know, this, if I remember this story correctly, he was put in touch with some physician at Dana-Farber up in Boston, and that person connected him with some other physician who was actually at a conference in Frankfurt, I think, and the guy picked up the call. That's the other thing, because my dad was a physician. It helped him, I think, a little bit. There might be some kind of camaraderie among physicians. And he said, "No, but you know what? I know of this one person," and he connected me to that. He connected my dad to that person who was who turned out to be my radiation oncologist, Dr. Susan Walden at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And she said, "You know what? This tumor is too large to be dealt with radiation, but we have this physician here that we work with at Cornell. Dr. Greenfield might be able to go in from above. This is being recounted from my dad, and my dad didn't understand what she meant, really. So my dad ended up scheduling an appointment with Dr. Greenfield. I went there, and Dr. Greenfield explained that he thought that he'd actually be able to do this surgery, a minimally invasive surgery is what he called it, and which is like kind of like, what are you talking, like minimally invasive brain surgery?
Oxymoron.
It's like, this is like a contradiction. It's like an oxymoron, like a contradiction in terms. It's like, are you really a doctor? Where am I? And then he explained it.
Don't mind me, I have dementia.
Yeah, exactly. Which, by the way, I kept forgetting what he kept saying in the conversation, but he said minimally invasive brain surgery, and he said with no side effects, that he could do it with no side effects. Now, you know, he had normally, he was surprisingly, I'm not going to say confident, though he was, because he's also, when I say confident, I don't want to convey, he was amazing. Like he was gentle. He was sweet. He was personable. He listened to me. He asked me what symptoms I was having. And after all of that, he said, I think that, you know, we can do this and we can do it, you know, with no side effects or minimal side effects. He said the only side effects that, you know, might be some bleeding, but that's sort of ephemeral and ephemeral. It's on the surface, and he's never had that, and it wouldn't present a real issue anyway. And he turned out to be right.
So you pulled the trigger, after this long journey, you have the surgery. Going into the surgery, you're at probably the peak of your dementia.
Yeah.
What happens when you wake up?
It really, you know, there's, they say that every age is, we're impacted by the technologies or the sort of the tools or whatever it is. We reach for metaphors in the world in which we live. And it's, technology is such a omnipresent part of our lives, and I've thought about this whole experience so in metaphorically technological terms, and it really was like getting rebooted, or in this case, like having the server being reconnected to the client. You know, the pipeline was reinstated, and all of a sudden I was when I came to, which was in the operating room, I understood where I was, which at the time I didn't understand. It didn't occur to me. I didn't say, wait, I understand where I am. That's interesting. But I did understand where I was, and I immediately started asking my dad questions. And my dad, I could see from my father's face that, he started to tear up. I could see that something had changed for the better. And it was as if, I mean, it was immediate. I mean, the changes were immediate. It was, it's hard to convey. It's like, I want to, it really was that, it was like a switch was flipped. The pressure was taken off the cognitive areas of my brain because this cyst, it was a cystic tumor for the most part, and it had inflated so quickly. And it was really putting up all this pressure up against my brain. And the surgery totally deflated and alleviated that pressure. And when the pressure was gone, I guess, Dr. Greenfield said actually that he could see that once the tumor fell away, and they didn't know if it would fall away, it could have actually invaded the hypothalamic wall. So this could have been we didn't know what we were dealing with until we got in there. And it was the best possible outcome. And it just fell away. And then he said he could see the hypothalamus, which is sort of like the thermostat of the body, but above the hypothalamus are these cognitive areas. He could see it pulsating. And I guess, you know, and I'm not a doctor. I guess something about that pulsation, perhaps the fact that blood was flowing again, all those things, pointed to, you know, return to normal brain function. So I think that the normal brain function was almost, if not immediate, and then simultaneously began a process of reacquisition of memories that I thought were lost, but in fact were kind of just waiting to be redownloaded or to be downloaded for the first time. They had been written, you know, to the hard drive, but they hadn't been sort of put on the RAM, or they hadn't been fully integrated, you know. And that was that process, which was those 3 days in the hospital or 2 days in the hospital, depending on how you count it. And then, you know, subsequently for, you know, at most maybe 2 months after the surgery.
I imagine that it must have been something like when you've been on a long flight, you know, a transatlantic flight, and your phone is in airplane mode, and then you land, you turn off airplane mode, and everything you missed while you were in flight starts to flood in, you know, the calls, the emails, and all of that. It must have been incredibly overwhelming, but also perhaps an incredible sense of gratitude as well. Share with us a little bit about what those, you know, next few months were like and how it shaped your ambition and your view on the world and your place in it.
Yeah, that's a pretty good analogy. I think to maybe try and capture it even more, I would say, imagine if you were like offline for years and you're getting emails from like, you know, yesterday, you're getting email, you're getting all the data out of place. So there was, I was piecing things together in a way that was, I was learning about things that happened out of order. And it's hard to convey. I mean, it's hard for me to convey here. I've tried to do that in writing. It's been such a long time ago. And I think one of the things I'm conscious of with these conversations, it's easier with you guys because we know each other, but it's, you know, as we get older and the memory becomes more of, it becomes more altered. Every time we access it, we alter it. And so it's hard to really, like I said, I've written about it, but the gratitude was, something else I've written about, which was that I understood what love was, or I developed a much more expansive sense of love after my surgery, but I had some concept of love. I don't think I ever really understood gratitude. I mean, certainly after my surgery, that's what I would say when I would talk about it. I would say, I had no idea what gratitude was. Like, I didn't even hear, I feel like I didn't even know what the word meant. You know, like I literally had no relationship to that word. But before my surgery, I had sort of, you know, wondered aloud what, in great distress. I mean, I was distressed, you know, I was really distressed. And that's the appropriate word I would describe for my emotional state heading into my surgery. I was not in a good place. And I felt cheated. I felt betrayed by life. The injustice of my circumstances was just foremost on my mind. And I, you know, wondered what it was all for. What was the point? What was this tragedy for? And after my surgery, it was as if someone had put, quite literally, I mean, this is how I wrote about it at the time. I don't know if I wrote it in my story, but I've talked about it. It was as if someone took one of those small little cassettes from the dictaphones, and they just put it in my head, and they just had love and gratitude just on repeat. And it was literally like a foreign voice in my head saying love and gratitude, love and gratitude, love and gratitude. After my surgery, I was sitting in the bed, and it really was like that. These words just repeating in my head, and it wasn't like I was saying them. And then I asked my father to get me my phone, and I started writing down all the names and numbers of the people who, in the months leading to my surgery, who I felt had been there for me. And I wrote all those names and numbers down, and after my parents left, I started making phone calls to people. So I freaked some people. I must be the only pick up. They're like, because they knew I was going into surgery, and they're like, I don't even know what this is. Like, you know, who is this person calling me? This can't be possible. But I did get some of the pickup, and it was really, they were incredible conversations. But that was the first kind of me expressing my gratitude, but gratitude became a really big thing for me. And it was, I think, most expressed during my radiation, which was, my surgery was June, I think, if I remember now, 17th or 13th. And then my radiation began at the very end of the summer in August, and that went for 6 weeks. And it sounds like BS. It really does. And I've tried to think of ways to say it that doesn't sound like it isn't, like I'm somehow exaggerating, but it really was the greatest honor of my life to be at Memorial Sloan Kettering in the radiation oncology unit, in the waiting room, around these people who, most of them were dealing with cancers. In fact, I don't know that any of them were dealing with what I was dealing with. Brain tumors, children, babies, couples, fathers, children, all sorts of people with all sorts of different situations, all of them there every day. And it was the most beautiful experience of my life. I said after it was over, I said that, you know, I was sitting with my therapist, and I was speaking with him, and I said, you know, I definitely don't want to go through that again, but I almost kind of do, you know. And I obviously, I didn't mean that I wanted to go through radiation again, but being, the radiation was for me the most, the closest sustained relationship that I've had with mortality and with vulnerability and surrender and gratitude and love and just all of that. And it was a great honor for me to go through that in the way that I did. So I hope that kind of long-winded answered your question.
Right on brand. So Dimitri, I got to know you through being a guest on your wonderful podcast, and I've become your friend, and both George and I consider you close friends now. I pointed out to you in a private conversation that my belief is that you are so grateful for the second chance in life that you got, that Hidden Forces is this expression of your strong desire to not waste one second of it. And I think the reason why your show, in part, is so successful is because you put the time in, you put the work in. You're almost manic about preparation, unlike any other podcast hosts on the planet, the Press and Company included. And I think that was a bit of an insight to you. I mean, have you thought about it since we spoke on that topic? I mean, is that potentially one of the motivations for why you put in so much time into Hidden Forces and why you have the strong desire to get the most out of every guest and the most out of every episode that you do?
It's funny, when you told me that, it might have been the first time that I'd ever maybe even thought about that. You might have introduced that into my mind, but I think you're right. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that if you look at the episodes that I did in the beginning, I mean, I did an episode on space war, episode, I think it was 6. I did an episode on the philosophy of mathematics, philosophical mathematics, episodes on complexity science, cyber war. These are the first like 10 episodes or so. There was a desire to kind of put the car in gear and kind of see what you can do, you know. And there was a lot of, I think, also not just to see what I could do with it, but to play. It was fun, you know. It is fun, but it was, I think, during those early days, maybe the first 30 episodes or so, it was a thrill. You know, it was the first time that I had really reclaimed that. You got to remember, like, after my surgery, we didn't talk about this, and this is a whole nother chapter, but, you know, I struggled for about 3 years in order to sort of figure out how and where and what I wanted to do with my life again, because I missed what I used to do. I mean, doing a television show with absolutely no experience. An internationally live broadcasted program daily, live, every day, 5 days a week. And the burden is on you to create it. Everyone's expecting you to, and you have zero experience. I mean, that is such a thrill, and it's so exciting, and it's such a platform, and I missed it, but I didn't, what I was doing then, I didn't want to do anymore, and I so desperately wanted to know the answer. You know, I did this episode with Jerry Colonna, who was a venture capitalist, and has since been sort of a life coach after he went through suicidal depression, and he just sort of what we call a midlife crisis, but it was very deep. And he talks about something in his book, something similar, which is that that the path is windy, but we want to know which way leads to bliss. And those are fundamentally contradictory, that the path to self-actualization is windy, and we each have our own path, but we so want to know which way will lead to bliss. We want to know which way will lead to actualization, which is, again, that's not the path to actualization. You know, it's hard. So I lost my train of thought, guys. What was the original?
No, that's quite all right. I mean, I'm just really enjoying you talking about this because I think about all the different paths that I've been led down, even just listening to various episodes of your podcast. And this whole concept of, you know, life being winding, but we want to know which way leads to bliss is fascinating because it really is all right in the same spot. It's all an interpretation, I think, in many ways. It's our perspective on everything that is, has been, is where we are now, that can open that up separate from actually any direction being chosen. That's a little philosophical, but taking maybe a step back from there, you know, you cover a wide range of topics on Hidden Forces. You have an incredibly impressive guest list of individuals that come on your show. As you've been putting this together over time, what is your philosophy for how you engage with different experts covering different areas of expertise? And what is your vision for where you head with this over the course of the next however long?
I think part of the answer is there is no vision, part of it, right? I don't have a grand strategy, and this actually is kind of one of the things that flaw, I don't know what you would call it. It's one of the things that I've had to work on because it makes it difficult to bring people in. Because it's hard for me to convey the larger strategy for something that I'm working on, because so much of what I do is just kind of intuition. There's a sort of strongly artistic part of this process. But in terms of a vision, I mean, there's also, I would also say there are a set of values, right? I know you guys can relate to this. There are certain things that, you know, I will do, and there's certain things I won't do, and I really want this program to be a source of truth. Is that's too much. I don't know if that I would go that far, but I want it to be an honest appraisal of the world, my attempt at grappling with the complexity of the world. I try as much as, and in the early days, I think very early on, I think that one of the things that happened with the program that I don't do anymore is there was an insecurity and a need on my part to convey to listeners that, yes, I know about these topics also. I'm smart. I got this. Yeah. But please like me, you know? So that was, I think, early on. And then as I got more comfortable, I think, the excitement, of having guests on, certain guests on, sometimes caused me to talk more than I would like to. But I think as the time has gone on, I've gotten more comfortable and more used to just having this platform and having these opportunities. And so I think what I want is for this podcast to be a place where I can bring on people to talk about the most important issues of the day, maybe not necessarily in the news of the day, but, you know, timely topics or relevant topics, current affairs related topics, even if they're science, even if they're science related, even if they have a huge backstory, even if they're historical, but somehow relevant to people's lives. And to help people, give them the tools. I mean, I used to have an intro for, it was a form of the intro in back in the day where I talked about that Hidden Forces is about giving people the tools they need to help navigate an increasingly complex world so that they're less surprised by tomorrow and better able to predict what happens next. That's, again, a bit of a kind of a marketing statement. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, you're going to be any better at predicting, but I do think that one of the aims is if you're a listener of this program or have been for a while, and I think it's been proven to be true in certain instances where the kind of stuff that we cover, if you're a regular listener, then I think some of the things that happen in the world later on will be less surprising to you. And I guess the way that I used to think of it was, you know, when 9/11 happened, even if, you know, there was no monetary advantage to being aware ahead of time that this was a possibility, even if you were not in physical danger, and there was no material reward to having some sense of it happening, that there was a benefit to just not being shocked and surprised.
So let's wrap up with your foray into Tesla. How you sort of came onto the story. You've had a couple of guests on that are skeptical of Tesla, myself included. It was a great privilege to be on your show. Talk to us a bit about what brought you to the story, what you your experience in having some guests on, maybe some of the blowback, the sort of counterpunch from the cult, as I would call it. It's got to be a fascinating experience. You know, you're a person who does literally dozens and dozens of different topics, and then suddenly you step into this world. Talk to us about that experience.
Geez.
Because I know it's been fascinating.
Oh my God. Well, I mean, as you probably know, the show has really just a crazy number of great reviews and just a handful of bad ones.
We got some to spare if you're looking for some.
Pretty sure they're almost all from Tesla fanatics, and I also was contacted. One of the more interesting stories. I won't mention his name, but I was contacted by someone who is he's kind of like a kind of geek slash tech sort of veteran in Silicon Valley slash author who wrote a really, really great book, which he brought to me and gave me, which I would have been interested in reading if the conversation with him hadn't been so, I think, gotten so kind of sour towards the end. But he was, and I don't know if he still is, writing a book about basically how Tesla short sellers are basically evil people who are, you know, trying to destroy Elon and the EV and green movement. I'm kind of, you know, I'm being maybe a little harsh on him, but that was generally the sense I got.
It's weird. I've never run into that accusation before. This is a first.
Yeah, exactly. He seemed too intelligent to be so, so kind of just, you know, straight jacketed. But he, you know, another interesting thing is he went on my Patreon account. As you know, I have a Patreon subscription model, and he got the super nerd tier, so he downloaded all my transcripts and all my rundowns, and then somehow he never paid. And it made no sense. And I contacted Patreon after. It's just a weird story. The guy figured out how to basically get all my stuff and not pay for it. And he was telling me during our conversation how great it was that I put all these transcripts out. He's like, you know, more people should do that, you know. And we went through all my Tesla episodes and started criticizing this person, that person, and telling me why didn't I hold him accountable for this? Why didn't I hold him accountable for that? And I never told him, hey, by the way, where's my money? You know, because I had already talked to Patreon. Anyway, a whole nother thing. But so this is the kind of characters I'm dealing with here. But he was extremely critical. And when I asked him just, you know, questions about Elon and some of the stuff that I found manifestly, unethical? I think that's a sufficient word to use. That's one word to use. He used a lot of words. You know, he like everyone that I've spoken to who's a Tesla bull, they find a way to excuse it. And I think in some way I kind of get it in some ways, right? I mean, in the sense that I think we can all find ways to kind of out of sight, out of mind, you know, to put on, you know, the Steve Jobs reality distortion field. If we want something to be true, we ignore the things that, kind of aren't convenient. I think we all have done this in one way or another in our lives, but it's present to a point with Tesla that doesn't quite make sense because so many people have been infected with this virus. And I'm not, by the way, to be clear, I know everything I know from Tesla from you guys. I learned about Tesla beginning with Charlie Grant. I know Charlie going back years, and I respect Charlie. I know how, not just how smart he is as an individual, thoughtful, but I know what kind of a man he is. I respect him as a man, as a person. I respect his ethics. I know he's also a very down to earth person, but Charlie's extremely down to earth. So when I saw that Charlie was writing critically about Tesla, as someone who kind of, I wouldn't say I idolized Elon Musk, but I was like, man, this guy's the man. You know, this guy's shooting rockets into space. He's building electric cars. He's putting on solar roofs. He's plowing tunnels under LA. I mean, this guy is Iron Man.
A real man.
Yeah. There goes a man.
Yeah, totally. You know, I was all for it. In fact, I had bought one of his biographies. I was going to read it, and I spoke to Charlie, and I was kind of taken aback by this, and so I started, and of course I, you know, Grant Williams, praise to Grant Williams, who had, I think, arguably, if not the best finance investing podcast, I think the most artistic and the best in a particular. I mean, I would put his, I think at the time that his podcast, Investors in Finance, was out, there was Patrick O'Shaughnessy's Invest Like the Best. Those two, I think, were really, I don't know, the best stuff that I was seeing out there. And Grant, so he's such a soulful person, and that comes across. And he had people on his program, and he talked about Tesla, and I respect Grant, and also, again, an ethical, good person. And so it took notice. And so what I've learned from all of you guys. So my issues with Tesla, you know, besides that, because that's me learning from you guys. My real issue, again, it's not with Tesla. It's watching Elon more closely. You know, I wasn't paying attention. You know, he was like the neighbor that you see coming in and out of the house saying hi. And you never really kind of listen. But when you kind of, You start listening a little closer, you start hearing screams from the house, and you start, you know, you start to notice things like maybe, you know, you start to notice aberrant behaviors that begin to raise alarm bells. And I wasn't noticing those things, the dead bodies, so to speak. I wasn't cognizant of those. And I picked up on those things, and I have a hard time excusing them. And, but I think also, again, Grant Williams has talked about this. This company is paradigmatic, and this man is paradigmatic, and this story is paradigmatic of where we are at this stage in the cycle. I mean, the stock, I think, yesterday hit what? Thing?
We don't talk about the stock on this podcast.
We'll bleep that.
I mean, it was wild. It went up like dollars off of like bad news.
Yeah.
I mean, and then this, again, I guess, another brilliant...
What are you trying to do to me here, Dimitri? What are you doing? I thought we were friends. What's going on?
Let me just say this. Another great person, Mike Green, who I had on the program, really smart guy. And again, one of those guys that's like, there's some people that I meet and I'm like, don't you know how smart you are? I feel like he's so much smarter than he even realizes. And he, you know, he has his thesis on passive investment. And I think that can go some way to explaining these types of phenomenons. I mean, not the burst in the stock, let's say yesterday, but hey, I'll stop talking about the stock. I'm sorry. Charts. I'm sorry. I'll stop. I'm just digging. I gotta stop digging. I'm putting the shovel down. I'm putting it down.
You got to get me back for digging so deep into your tumor.
Exactly.
No, that's fair. It's good for someone to come on and give TC a little bit of a hard time.
No, I didn't mean to do that.
As you mentioned, things are really spiraling into a stratosphere that is hard to even believe that it exists. One of the patterns that, you know, certainly that we see is that, you know, bad behavior is being rewarded these days. I don't think it's just happening in Tesla. It's happening all over the place. Fraud creates alpha. There's very little penalty for breaking the rules. As a natural born rules follower, this is absolutely infuriating for me. But what do you, you know, do you see any cracks in the facade here? Do you think that this will resolve in a satisfying way in our lifetime? What's your perspective?
So you said you're so funny. Fraud is a source of alpha. It's like Bernie. That's like people that were invested in Bernie Madoff's fund. You know, it's like Markopoulos said. Harry Markopoulos. He said it's like everyone knew they were investing in a fraud. Like that's why the thing was going up 15% every year, steady growth. But they were like, you know, they thought that they were investing in their fraud. I'm not qualified to say this again, right? Like one of the benefits of doing my program is that I learn how stupid I am, at least, you know, in all these different areas. I might be smart overall because I've got all these different areas that I get to plug people's brains on. But, I've had so many brilliant people on, guys like Howard Marks, who they're always uncertain, right? They never ever convey any amount of certainty or say that they know anything. I think it's Mike Green, I think, has helped me a lot, among others, to think about what's happening. Because I do think, it seems to me that something really deep down the vector, something fundamental in the ecology has changed drastically, you know, like the climate conditions have changed, where it has a sort of macroscopic impact on everything. Is it the gravitational force of free money? Is it, you know, again, like Mike talks about the flows of passive, but something has changed where the way that we've thought about or think about investing and we think about valuations, is not applicable to this market today. And the question really is, when and how does this shift occur? And I don't know, but humanity, fundamental human nature hasn't changed, and we still live in a physical world with physical constraints. The fact that our financial markets are behaving in or the underlying conditions or assumptions that undergird our markets are fundamentally different, let's say, than they were before 2008, doesn't change the fact that we live in a physical world with physical constraints, and that human beings with mammalian brains and brain stems and amygdalas and behavioral impulses for fear and greed are the ones making the decisions here. I don't think that this is going to last forever, but I'm not sure how we get from here to there. Because I think what's different in this environment, you know, I talked about, yes, the Fed, but I think one of the larger forces, so to speak, is the activism by policymakers and governments, the fact that they have, I think now just embrace doesn't even capture it. I mean, they've embraced this role. They've accepted it. this is now where they're at. They're, I think, committed to sustaining asset valuations. And I think when you look at the issue of demographics, pension funds, things like this, the political implications of a collapse in asset prices, of a decline in liquidity, I think those are so scary to people. And also, like, internationally, you have a country like China, right? I mean, this latest thing with the virus, I know you guys have been tracking that. I know Charts has been tracking this. But, you know, this is another good example. Like, we know that they were, at least in the beginning, covering stuff up. You know, the New York Times covered this recently on the Daily, and I'm sure it's come out in some of their articles. So there's a lot of management and a lot of power by the authorities, and they have the tools to really screw things up. You know, Jim Grant talks about this. If he years ago when he came on Capital Account, he had said that the first thing he would do if he was appointed to the Federal Reserve. Well, actually, I think he might have said the first thing he would do would be resign. No, but I think, though, he's so funny.
He is.
He's such a funny person. He's so hilarious. But he talked about setting up an Office of Unintended Consequences. So we're kind of just in this giant mess, you know, and it's really hard to know because there's what I think we can, even if you're willing to agree that policymakers are committed 100% to preventing a decline in asset prices.
Mm-hmm.
The question also is, like, can they, you know? And, you know, and that's the whole, the traditional inflation-deflation debate that, you know, was raging before 2012, 2013, and might be coming back up again now. We'll see. I don't know.
So, well, Dimitri, it's been a wonderful time together. We're super thrilled that you took some time out of your busy schedule to come on the podcast. We won't resolve these things now. We're very grateful that you opened up as much as you did about your own existential crisis and the rebirth. And we're very proud of the things you're doing with Hidden Forces. And, you know, if the Tesla story ever breaks, I'm sure Georgia and I would be thrilled to come out to New York and be on Hidden Forces again.
No, I would love to have both of you on the program. And guys, seriously, I'm amazed at how you've taken to this, both of you. You're such naturals at it, and your production quality is really high. You guys are like, I was thinking about this a few days ago, you guys are like the NPR characters from the SNL skit with Alec Baldwin and the sweaty balls. You have the sweaty balls voices.
And those horrible sweaters.
The horrible sweaters.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I think we're drifting off brand with the sweaty balls.
Yeah, we'll have to bleep a couple of things.
It was my pleasure, guys.
No, it's kind of you to say that, Dimitri. You know, TC and I do a lot of fun things, but this is by far the most fun thing that we get to do. So thanks for coming on, and we'll look forward to the next time.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Opportunity heroes comes and goes in a flash. You gotta take that chance or turn your chips in for cash. Just when you think hope and wisdom are dead, Athena springs from Zeus's head. Hun, please scratch that order that I just said.
Yes, sir.
Seize the day. I'll have a feta chicken on pita bread. We'll be right back.